hoping against hope, Susan, that we will actually complete the book by Purim. I believe it's doable. But then again, I believe a lot of things, so who knows. We are in Perek Gimel. We're still in the third chapter, although I do expect to complete our look at the third chapter today and even get started on the fourth. We've done a lot in Perek Gimel, but I'm not actually going to review it now. And the reason I'm not going to review it now is because as you look at your source sheet, you'll see that I have review questions that cover the highlights of all of the first three chapters. So rather than spend time reviewing in order to come back and review again in 15 minutes, I'd rather that we just launch right in. The last thing that we had discussed was the lottery run by Haman and the message of lotteries in the Torah and the message of the lottery in Megillat Esther, how the lottery seems to defeat Haman because it gives him the latest possible date. It prolongs this period when the Jews can actually do something about it. And we talked about then what the goal is of the lottery, and we saw it potentially as part of the religious message of the book, that Haman is trying to discern the divine will. Haman wants to get God on his side, so to speak, but in fact, God is on our side, giving a date that thwarts what Haman is trying to accomplish. We tied it into the Persian Nowruz, which I'm not going to go into right now, but it also explains why we name the holiday for the lottery. We're really naming it for the defeat of Haman's deity, whatever it was that he believed in, by Hashem. Okay, that brings me to a decision by Ahasuerus to decline the money. So as we begin, I will note that in general, the classes for this year are dedicated by Dana and Ilan Rubinstein. And I also would like to dedicate this particular session by Rochelle and Moish Rosenblum for Refuah Shlema for Sarah Leah Bas Shifra. So she should gain merit from the learning that we do. Ahasuerus declines Haman's offer of cash. That's what it looks like, right? If you go back to your Megillah and you look at Perek Gimel chapter 3, and specifically Pasuk Tet, sentence 9. So in chapter 3, sentence 9, Haman says to Ahasuerus, there is this nation, and so on. He describes them, and there's a lot to be said about his description of the Jews, but not right now. And Imal HaMelech Tov, if it's okay with the king, Yikasev Le'abdam, let it be written to destroy them. Let's get rid of these Jews. That's his request. Ba'aseres alafim kikar kesef eshkol al yedei osei hamalacha. And I am willing to pay, that's the most, read this line, I am willing to pay 10,000 silver kikar for their destruction. Okay. Lahavi al ginzei hamalach, to go into the king's storehouse, that's what I'm going to pay for those who do the work. And the king, for his part, hands him the ring, and says to Haman in Pasuk Yud Aleph in sentence 11, Vayomer HaMelech LeHaman, HaKesef Nasun Lach, the money is given to you, and the nation, do what you want. Okay, that's the story here as presented in Perek Gimel in chapter 3. So there are a lot of things that you could ask. Let's actually go back a step. Before I talk about him declining the money and handing it back to Haman, let's actually go back a step to Ahasuerus accepting Haman's pitch and saying, sure, I'm okay with the idea of destroying part of my empire. When you think about it, this is a really strange thing for Ahasuerus to accept, right? I mean, sight unseen. He hasn't even been told it's the Jews, right? He knows by the end of the Megillah. But right now, he hasn't even been told it's the Jews. He's told there are these upstarts in your kingdom. They don't follow all the rules, so let's destroy them. I mean, seriously? Like, is that a reasonable response to people who are problematic? If anything, you're creating more problems for yourself by doing that. You're going to have a war in your kingdom? A war of destruction? Is that really what you want? I mean, the Gemara is bothered by that and tries to amplify Haman's pitch to show why Ahasuerus would have been so offended. Leah writes a note in the chat, is this similar to the book of Daniel? But in the book of Daniel, there's no war against a particular nation within the empire. There's no move to destroy a nation within the empire. So Malbim comes up with a really interesting approach to this. And that's what I want us to see. He has a different understanding of Haman's sales pitch. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source number one. This is Malbim. Everyone has the sheet, I hope. It was sent out. People clicked on it. We're good? Okay. Hamavuar. He says, this is what I see here. This is clear, says Malbim. Shahaman ganav es lev Achashverosh b'shnei dvarim. He says, Haman tricks Achashverosh in two ways. Echad, one. He doesn't name the nation. Yeah, there's some nation out there. Now, what's the big deal about not naming them? So this is part of an idea from Malbim that we've seen before. Malbim is of the belief that to be a Jew in the Persian Empire is actually a good thing. The Jews are elevated. Remember that Malbim said Mordechai has an elevated role at the gate, at the king's gate. Why? Because, after all, Mordechai is a Jew, and the king likes Jews. The empire likes Jews. This goes back to Daniel being very influential in the Babylonian Empire and in the early Persian Empire. So therefore, it's actually good to be a Jew. So Haman says, I am not going to tell anybody that I'm talking about the Jews. I'm just going to say there is a nation that doesn't follow the rules. And so Malum continues to say, Shim haya Achashverosh yodeya shema Yehudim shayu mefursamim la'am chacham v'navon, lo haya shomei ala atzaso. If Achashverosh had known this was a Jew, oh no, he never would have said anything about the Jews. Absolutely. It's just so ironic because we're so used to thinking of Achashverosh as hating Jews. Malum says, no, he doesn't mind Jews. But then he goes further and says, even if it were some other lowly nation, had Haman said, I want to destroy them, Achashverosh would not have listened. That's not what Haman said. What did Haman say should be done? Pause here in the Malbim. What did Haman say should be done to this nation of troublemakers? What did he say you should do? Le'abed, right? He says le'abed. What does le'abed normally mean?
To lose. To lost.
To destroy. It's right, to make lost, effectively. Right. To destroy. However, Malbim catches something. Look at the end of the chapter of the decree that actually goes out with the order in sentence 13. Look what's in the scroll. What does it say?
Lahashmid, laharog,
ula'abed. To destroy, to kill, right? But he didn't say that to Achashverosh. He doesn't say laharog. He doesn't say lahashmid. He just says la'abed. Says the Malbim, he's playing games with Achashverosh. Continue in the second paragraph of source number one. Zos hadavar sheni sheganav libo. That's the second way in which Haman tricks Achashverosh. Shalo amar lo shirotzeh lahashmidam. He didn't say, I want to kill them all. Rak lavdam. I just want to destroy them. What does that mean? So he says, shepashtus biuro hula abed tsuras hauma. He says it means you get rid of their national identity, which is their religion. So Achashverosh thinks that what Haman wants to do is bring the Jews in line. Come up with some kind of a tactic to bring the Jews in line. That's all that Achashverosh thinks Haman wants to pull off. It's a remarkable idea. It is entirely counter to everything I learned about Megillas Esther over the years. I've never heard anybody suggest this before. Jeanette writes in the chat, so he convinced Ahasuerus this was assimilation. That's precisely right. That's exactly what Malbim is contending. So, you know, you read it and you think, huh, that's an interesting take. When I first read it, I thought that's an interesting take. Right, move on. But then I read Rav Amnon Bazak. He has a series of shiurim on Megillat Esther. And two of them are devoted to this idea. And I'm still not sold entirely on it, but he shows you how this fits Megillas Esther as a whole. Not just this point, but Esther as a whole. Take a look at chapter 4, sentence 7. We'll take a tour through the rest of the book. This is when Mordechai is telling Esther about the decree. So what does Mordechai tell Esther? Well, he tells the intervener to tell Esther. He's telling Hasach. He says, tell her, Eis kol asher karahu, everything that has happened. There's some debate as to what that means. Maybe it's his refusal to bow to Haman. Unclear. But he says, tell her everything that happened. And parashas hakesef, about the money that Haman said he was willing to pay. And, by the way, they want to destroy us. Here's the text in sentence 8. Why does Mordechai want Esther to know about the money? Ahasuerus refused the money. The money doesn't matter. Right? Why is he telling her, oh no, there's money involved? So you could suggest, it's just to say, this is how into it Haman is. He was willing to pay 10,000 silver coins. Okay, that's an argument. It's legit. 10,000 silver coins was a ton of money. If you look in Herodotus in the Persian records of the annual tax intake of the Persian Empire, it's something like 14,000 kikar kesef. So he's doing, you know, he's almost matching what the Persians take in a year. So it's a huge amount of money. Maybe you're just trying to show just how far Haman is willing to go. Says Rav Bazak, no. Mordechai is emphasizing the money aspect because what the money was not money being given to carry out the execution. This was for the Jews to be sold as slaves. That was what this was supposed to be. And Mordechai is telling Esther, you have to realize what's going on here. Haman told the king that this is a financial thing, that he's going to sell the Jews as slaves. But here's the text of the document, which says we are to be destroyed. Excuse me, which says that we are to be destroyed. So he's telling her, he's giving her the game. He's telling her, Haman and Ahasuerus are not on the same page. How does Mordechai know that? Because Mordechai hangs out at the palace gate. That's where all the news is. He has now given Esther the key. And that's going to matter a great deal. Because jump to chapter 7. Chapter 7, sentence 4. Esther makes the big reveal of Haman's identity. What does she say there in chapter 7, sentence 4? I see Chana saying it, but you're muted, Chana. Exactly. And I see Jeanette wrote it in the chat as well. Exactly. Esther says to Ahasuerus, if they would have sold us, I wouldn't say anything. In other words, you're not the bad guy, Ahasuerus. If Esther doesn't say that, it looks like she's accusing Ahasuerus of villainy. She says, no, if the plan was really what you approved, I wouldn't say anything. But it's not. You said that we should be sold. Haman turned around and he said we should be killed. And that's why Ahasuerus, in the next sentence, is able to honestly say, who in the world decreed that? He's not being disingenuous. It's true. I never approved that. That wasn't my idea. Mi hu zeh ve'ezeh hu. It's a brilliant idea. Which, again, I'm not so sure it's true, but it's a brilliant idea.
I literally have never heard another explanation of why she said, I've heard quite a few. Why she says that at the end, that makes as much sense as this one does.
Yeah. You know, when you learn Gemara, there's something called pilpul, right? You've heard the term pilpul? So the core method of pilpul is that you have a set of different laws and different texts, and someone comes up with a way to ingeniously explain the different texts and answer all of their problems and so on with an idea that is likely not actually correct in terms of what the Gemara meant. But it weaves everything together in a really, really nice tapestry. That's more or less what happens with Pilpul a lot of the time. That's what I feel like here. It's a magnificent idea. It explains a lot, right? It explains why it is that Mordechai wants to tell her about the money. It explains why Ahasuerus would have approved this thing in the first place. It explains the whole offer of the money, this massive sum. It explains why Esther says, if they were only selling us, it would be okay. It sure explains an awful lot. That's this idea from Malbim, as developed by Rav Bazak. Okay. So that's...
Rabbi?
Yes, Susan.
And I know you don't like when I quote my sources, but this says Malbim said something different than what you say.
Go ahead.
That's why it says, Malbim explains that the king wished to demonstrate his integrity, that he did not seek monetary gain, but merely wished to rid his kingdom of an undesirable element. He even offered Haman money from the royal treasury to finance the project.
So, it's a nice statement that they're making, but I showed you Malbim on the sheet. That's,
They said Malbim explains, that's why I'm saying that.
I understand, but you actually have the text of the Malbim in front of you. So I'm now opening up the Malbim on Esther to see. I have an idea about how what they're saying could
they
be reconciled.
It's on verse 11. It's from like,
yeah.
The silver.
Mm-hmm. All right, and I've got it in front of me. I'm going to share the screen in a moment so everybody will be able to see it as well.
I was just wondering, that's all.
And I wonder why they would say he said it. Clearly, you know, they think he did. So the Malbim is now in front of you on the screen. You see? Vayomer. Mevaer shenis tumas hamelach. It explains a second time the innocence of the king, meaning not understanding what's going on, not realizing he's talking about killing them. Bal yachshov adam sha'asa zeh bavur hakesef. Lest anybody say he's doing it for the sake of the money, like they say in there. Ki adarabba lefi machshavaso sherotzeh liyasher ha'am. He wants to set this nation straight. Ula abed roa dasam, and he wants to get rid of the bad aspects of their laws, umidosehem, and their traits. Amar lo shehu yitem lo akesef hatzarich lo tza al zemeyot v'sav. He said, I'll pay for it. In other words, it's entirely consistent. Malbim is consistent with what he said before. He doesn't believe it's murder. He believes it's what's over here, the part that I'm highlighting. La abed roa dasam umidosehem. Retraining, so to speak. That's what Malbim believes is going on. And the idea of not accepting the money is to show, I'm not doing this for my own sake. I'm doing this, in fact, for the sake of setting them straight. So we're good. Okay. So that's one piece here. Last note regarding this. The Maharal. Maharal, always fascinating, often unique, says something very interesting here. Regarding Achashverosh's response to Haman. Achashverosh says back to Haman, Hakesef natun lach. The money is given to you. Tell me something. If you really want to say to someone offered you money, and you want them not to give you that money, what do you say? What's the wording you'd use, English or Hebrew? Keep
no,
the money.
Thank you.
Keep the money. The money is yours. No, thank you. Is that what Achashverosh said?
No. Given. No.
He says the money is given to you. The money is given to you. So the truth is, if I take the read of Malbim and Rav Bazak, that's fine. I'm okay with that. But if I take the traditional read that Haman is offering, I will pay for the execution of the Jews, and he's saying you don't need to pay, the wording is a little bit off. Look at the Maharal in source number 2 with his explanation. He says this is about Achashverosh's ego. Ulefichach amar lahaman hakesef nasun lach. Therefore, he said, the money is given to you. The therefore is, as I wrote in the English translation, building on what Maharal says right before this, because Achashverosh was somebody who was always trying to consume things, He says, the money is given to you. Lo she'ein ani rotza kesef shalcha. He says, it's not that I don't want it. Rak mekabel ani mimcha. I accept your gift. V'chozer ani v'noseh lach. And now I'm giving it back to you. I'm taking it and then giving it back. V'lo achzik b'kesef. He didn't hold on to it. Shezeva dai hayelo gnai gadol kabel kesef. For him to take payment would have been disgraceful. It looks like he's just in it for the money. Laseis amachal dahariga bishvil kesef, to say I'm giving them up for execution just for the sake of the money. However, bishvil avas hakesef hayemekablo v'chozer v'nasan hakesef elav. But he loved money so much that he says, I want to take it first and then give it back to you. Maral says, what Achashverosh is saying is, I accept. He can't hold himself back. I have to accept it and then give it back. But the truth is, I thought I had brought more in here. The idea that I developed from there, that I thought I had in the text I brought you, I need to give you more text, but I'm not going to do that right now, is that Achashverosh has a need to be in the superior position. Achashverosh has a need to be in a position of power. So therefore, what he's saying is, the money is mine, but I grant it to you. It's my decision. That's the idea that I was trying to get across there. Okay. So I brought you, as I said in the beginning today, I brought you review questions on what we covered in the first three chapters. I am a very big believer in the idea of Chazara, and the idea of review, recognizing, though, that we also have to go forward. What I'm going to do here is just to run down the list quickly, answer the questions quickly, rather than do this as a back and forth. So, how is the Book of Esther different from the rest of Tanakh? It's the focus on the Jews in exile, which then becomes a model for later exiled Jews. It's Esther as the Book of Exile that makes it unique. Which Persian king is most likely the Achashverosh of Megillat Esther? We said that was Xerxes, based on the way the name Xerxes would have been written, but also based on the era when he lived and the writings of Herodotus in describing Xerxes. Xerxes makes the most sense. What are three levels of interpretation of Achashverosh's feast in chapter 1? You remember? We discussed this. It's a while ago. So, number 1 was a demonstration of power. That's the simplest read. Number 2, it's a celebration of the defeat and exile of the Jews. We had that whole discussion about the 70 years. And number 3, it's God's manipulation in order to put the pieces in place for Esther. So you'll have this big feast, and Vashti will come out, and everything that evolves through that feast. It's God putting pieces into place. How might the text of Megillat Esther hint that Achashverosh was celebrating the exile of the Jews? So we noted the fact that it's year 3 when he throws this big party instead of year 1. And you do the calculation of year 3, it comes out at the end of the 70. Also, the finery that the Megillah describes, the Ikar Tiferes Gedulaso, as well as the Kelim Shonim, the different utensils, and we went through the language on that, and the links to Belshazzar, how Belshazzar explicitly had a feast at which he brought out the temple vessels and all of that, and we link Achashverosh's conduct in the text to Belshazzar's conduct. Am I going too quickly with it? We're good? Okay. How
can I ask you one question?
Yes, Susan.
How does the celebration of the Jews losing and being exiled fit in with the Malbim?
It doesn't. It doesn't.
Okay.
You are correct. Meaning the read that he's celebrating the downfall of the Jews. Well, you could make it fit. I shouldn't say that quite so. Meaning you could make it fit. You could say he respects the Jews, but he wants them as exiles within his empire, not independent. That would be a way to deal with it. The fifth question. How did the sages determine that Vashti was the true royal in the family? So we said that it explained Achashverosh's odd attempt to put her on display, which normally would not have fit what a king would have done with his queen, and certainly not someone so insecure as Achashverosh. It also explains her very imperious response to him. She's not afraid of him at all. Sorry, not showing up, except she's not saying the word sorry. It explains his overreaction when she refuses, turning this into a political event, calling on the council to deal with this and issuing a big decree. It all fits with this being a political issue. And we said, it also fits the biblical archetype of the queen who holds the real power in the family, like with Izebel, with Jezebel, like with Atalia. Vashti refused to go to the party, and we said that there were two different explanations for why. Either she is not such a moral person, however God zapped her with whatever it was that God zapped her with, Tzarat or a tail or whatever that was. Or she was an unwilling victim. Meaning she's a victim of Ahasuerus, and she doesn't want to be used in this way. And we noted that to a certain extent, you can show that the first view, the view that she's immoral, is tied to Babylonian sources, and the latter view more towards sources in Israel. We asked in chapter 2, why does Ahasuerus want a new queen? One approach, he remembered how beautiful she was. Another approach, he remembered that she was killed unjustly. That's why the text said, remembered what was decreed upon her. Or his aides suggested it in order to calm him down, because he was angry that Vashti had been killed. He was angry at those who had told him to do it. And so they say, just, you know, make a new Vashti. Three reasons for why Esther does not share her identity. So we said, could be that she's hiding positive information, that was like Malbim, to avoid being picked. She doesn't want to become queen. Alternatively, it's bad to be identified as a Jew, and she wants to hide that information so that she can practice Judaism while she's in the palace. Or, Rav Chaim ibn Attar, the Or HaChaim, suggests, she is hiding negative information in order to get picked as queen. And all of these, we said, reflect the approaches of Jews in exile. Those who play up their status and those who play down their status. Why do Mordechai and Esther have the names of Mesopotamian gods? So we said that the argument that it's assimilation doesn't really fit the story. The Gemara has drashot to try to explain it. But fundamentally, we said, it resembles what happens with Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, that they are given Babylonian names. That's what happens in the Babylonian exile, and it's what happened to Mordechai and Esther before the Persians ever showed up. What do we learn from Mordechai's presence at the palace gate? So we said two possibilities. Either Mordechai has power as a dignitary from that exile, like Malbim, or that Mordechai is a supplicant. He's putting himself in position to intervene for the Jews and for the Beit HaMikdash they're trying to rebuild in Israel that has been halted at that point. Why does a Midrash ascribe to Esther the vegetarian practices that we learned about Daniel and his group? So we suggested either it's just intertextuality. You're taking two stories that have similarities and borrowing an element of one for the other and saying maybe they're meant to be linked. Or Daniel is actually still meddling, because Daniel doesn't die in the text. We don't know that Daniel ever dies here. We know he's around in the beginning of the Persian Empire, and we know that he practiced this vegetarianism, so it's possible that he actually institutes this for Esther. We still with us? We're good? Okay, that brings us to chapter 3. Why does Ahasuerus elevate Haman? So either it's rags to riches, to avoid a threat, he wants to elevate someone who is lowly, who will now rely on him only, and that way he'll be protected from others. Or it's churning within the court. Haman was memuchan; he was an advisor already. After there's an assassination attempt, he says, "I need to clean house a little bit." Or it's an attempt to satisfy Esther, because mehuman. Maybe Haman, and Mehuman was the one who said to create that whole pageant that brought Esther into power, so he's making her happy by elevating the man who brought her there in the first place. We asked why Mordechai refuses to bow, and we gave two basic ideas. One, it's about idolatry. Haman makes himself a god, he has a god around his neck, or the issue of appearances. Or it's a statement like that of Daniel about Jewish identity. I'm not willing to surrender my identity. And then the lottery we already reviewed in the beginning of today, so I'm not going to take us through the lottery and the line about why Achashverosh says the money is given to you was what we just discussed. I didn't bring in here the question about what Haman, you know, did to Achashverosh. Did he trick Achashverosh or not? That should really be a question in here also. Haman's trick, according to Malbim. Okay. All right, so that's just a review of chapters 1 to 3. I hope that that's somewhat helpful. But let's get started on chapter 4. We have so much to talk about here. If you take a look at the bottom of the first sheet, brief outline, right? The chapter begins with the grief of Mordechai and the Jews. Sackcloth, ashes, fasting, grief. Then you have Mordechai letting Esther know what's going on. Before Mordechai pushes Esther to act, and Esther comes up with her plan, the 3-day fast, and then she's going to go to Achashverosh. What would you see as the themes in this chapter? It's a very down-to-earth chapter. Like, it's a very basic sort of, you know, set of events. But what would you view as a theme in this chapter?
Esther's role and how she brought above the Savior.
Okay, but bigger picture, beyond the individual characters in our account here. Power of tshuva, and someone else said?
Human endeavor.
The human beings acting as opposed to only praying, because they're gonna pray and fast, but she's also going to Achashverosh. True. Tshuva, we don't yet see. I mean, I guess you see them planning on doing it via their fasting. So I would look at this and see a couple of other things, not disagreeing with what's been said. But the Jew as a member of a non-Jewish royal court, the vulnerability that Esther speaks to here, I can't go see him. If I go see him, I'm going to get killed, right? The precarious position that a Jew has as a member of the royal court, I think that's a very important theme in this chapter. Speaking to what happens with Jews in general in that kind of position. Yes, Hannah?
She's not representing a Jew here at this point.
Well, she's going to if she goes into protest.
It's true.
Yeah. So I think that's one piece. And then the other piece is the responsibility for Klal Yisrael, the responsibility to act on behalf of others, to actually endanger yourself on behalf of others. So with those themes in mind, I'm going to ask you three questions about this chapter, not for you to answer right now, but just to set up where I want to go with this chapter. Number one, I want to know, why won't Esther go to Achashverosh? I mean, we play this off as a wonderful example of Esther putting herself on the line in order to save her people. And it is. But why, like, I mean, would someone really decline in the first place? What would we think of somebody who said, my life versus saving my entire nation, I'll take myself first? What would you think of someone like that? Right? I mean, it's hard to imagine that we could, you know, that we could see a moral person put their survival. I mean, people do, don't get me wrong. People do put their own survival ahead of that of others. But, yeah, Debbie's smiling, ever the cynic. But nonetheless, it's hard to imagine. Why is Esther refusing to go in the first place? That's one question. Question number two, why is Achashverosh afraid of unplanned meetings? What's that about? Why is that no one gets to go in? Like, that's not a way to run a kingdom. So that's a second question. I'm not asking you to answer the questions yet. I'm just throwing out the questions. And then third, how does Mordechai convince Esther to go? What is it about Mordechai's pitch, which at the end of the day doesn't include any information she didn't know, right? He isn't telling her anything she wasn't aware of. So how does he convince Esther that she should go? Those are the three things that I'd like to tackle in this chapter. So let's start with the first one. Esther's refusal. I would have hoped that people would generally put the survival of their nation ahead of themselves. But I'm going to offer you four ideas here. The first two ideas are literalist ideas, just very straightforward. The third idea is an ethical statement from David Zinsheim. And then the fourth idea is a fascinating political idea from Yoram Chazoni, which I'm not sure I agree with it, but it's brilliant. They put it in the same camp as the idea from Malbim and Rav Bazak in chapter 3. It's a brilliant idea for sure. Whether you can apply it here or not is less certain. But first, the literalist approach. So Rashi here says she's not refusing to go. She thinks going is not necessary. If you take a look at source number 3 on your sheet, the top of the second side, she says, "Umi yodea im le'et kazot," or sorry, Mordechai says, "Umi yodea im le'et kazot higa'at." Who knows if for a time like this you arrived on the throne? "Umi yodea im yachpots bich hamelech l'shana haba'ah shuzmana hariga." Mordechai says to Esther, you know, maybe the king isn't going to be interested in you next year. From Mordechai's response, you understand what Esther was saying. Esther was saying, there's a year to go. We don't know how much time elapses between Haman's decree and this moment. The Medrash, of course, tells us that almost no time elapses, and that's why they end up fasting on Pesach. But just the straight read of it, this is all imminent. This all happens right away. So she has 11 months to go, and she says, I don't think I need to endanger myself to go now. To which Mordechai's response is, you know, right now your stock is high. Who knows where things are a year from now? As he continues to say, Higat l'malchut, you arrived at this state of being on the throne. Im tagi l'gdula shat ba'achshav. Maybe next year you won't be in this kind of position. Maybe Achashverosh is going to throw a party and ask you to do something you don't want to do. So Rashi gives you a very straightforward, literal read. He says, "What if you look at the text, you realize that she has a lot of time, and what she's saying is, I shouldn't go yet. Maybe I won't need to go yet. Maybe something else will happen." Makes sense. Malbim is also literal here. He adds a component. Take a look at chapter 4, sentence 11, please. Esther says to Mordechai, everybody knows, everybody is aware, you can't go to the king unsummoned. King gets to kill whoever does that. And then she adds something. I have not been called to the king in 30 days. How do you take that? How do you read that line, I haven't been called to the king in 30 days?
To sleep with him.
To sleep with him, yes. But what's the, why is she mentioning it?
She's saying that his interest in her seems
to be waned. If she can't see him, who can?
So one way to take it is,
it's waned.
Right. So one way to take it is what Gita says. I'm not sure I didn't hear you well, Susan.
I said that he waned.
He waned. Oh, his interest waned in her. Yeah. He doesn't like me anymore. Right? That's one way to read it. Is 30 days he hasn't called me. I have no leverage with this guy. That's one way to look at it. What's another way you could read it, though? So Malbim offers you a different take. Take a look at source number 4. Achar sha'ani lo nikreti lavo al ha-melech ze shaloshim yom. Since I have not been called to the king for 30 days, halo vaday b'yamim achadim yikra'uti. He's going to call me soon. V'azia yoter b'kal levakesh b'ad ha'am. And then it'll be easier to petition on behalf of the nation. She says, why should I endanger myself by going to him now? He's calling for me any day. That's the way that that Malbim reads it. Also, a very straightforward and literal approach. So, these approaches solve the problem of why Esther refuses by saying she's not refusing. She's willing to go. Either she's saying, I may not need to because there are 11 months to go. Stuff happens in that period of time. Or he's going to call me first, so I don't need to put myself in danger. Two reasonable explanations. Rav David Zinsheim offers you a different approach. I mentioned him a while back, just to reintroduce him for those who are not familiar. He was the rabbi who was the head of Napoleon's Sanhedrin. Talk about somebody who knows what it's like to be a Jew in exile and in the court. Napoleon wants to determine whether the Jews can be civilized, so he first creates the Assembly of Jewish Notables and asks them to answer questions related to Jewish loyalty to his empire. And then he wants this rabbinic group, his Sanhedrin, to basically ratify what the Assembly of Jewish Notables had said. And Rabbi Zinsheim has the remarkable task of leading the group of rabbis who are collected from across the spectrum and try to get them to come up with answers that will suit what Napoleon wants to hear. Magnificent story in and of itself, but not for right now. What does he say here? He says this was actually an ethical issue. Not a matter of practicality, but a matter of maybe I don't need to go because the Jews will have atoned for whatever it was that brought them here in the first place. It's source number 5. I didn't translate it on the sheet. I burned out on translating. I translated all the other sources. I just got tired, and it was a long source. But I'm going to read it with you and explain it, and you have the original in front of you. He says, Vadai tamua. He says, this is shocking. Esther hatzadeket eich lo ratzta lachnis atzma b'sakana b'shvil kol Yisrael. Righteous Esther isn't going to endanger herself for the sake of all Israel. Elisha amra lefi divrei Mordechai ki achet hu b'shvil avodah zarah. V'ukvar tikeni. The answer is that she thought, as Mordechai had indicated to her, and he has a basis for that that he doesn't quote here, but I'll explain shortly, that the reason why this was happening to the Jews was because they had worshipped idols. That's why this is happening to the Jews. It's for avodah zarah. It's for idolatry. V'hu kvar tikein. And Mordechai had already corrected that by refusing to bow to Haman. Where do you get the idea that it's about idolatry? Take a look at source number 6. It's the Gemara in Megillah. When Esther sends back to Mordechai, she knows he's in sackcloth, ladat mazeh ve'al mazeh, to know what this is all about. The phrase mazeh ve'al mazeh is an odd phrase. And so Rabbi Yitzchak in the Gemara says, I'll tell you what that phrase means. The luchot, the tablets that Moshe brought from Sinai, mizeh u'mizeh heim ketuvim. They have writing on both sides, says the Torah. So ladat mazeh ve'al mazeh is mizeh u'mizeh. She said maybe the Jews have violated the 5 books of the Torah. Maybe they have worshipped idols. Now, this is clearly drash. This is clearly not pshat in what she asked when she said, ladat mazeh ve'al mazeh. And it's worth a discussion some point in terms of the midrash, why the midrash goes that route. But I'm explaining Rabbi Zinsheim right now. And he says, Esther thought the reason why the Jews are in danger is because they worshipped avodah zarah, because they worshipped idols. That's what Esther was thinking. And she thought, Mordechai already took care of that. He refused to bow to Haman. And therefore, I don't need to endanger myself. Why should I endanger myself to go to Achashverosh? It's all taken care of. The decree is gonna disappear. That's what she thought. Middle of the second line in source 5. Omnam achar kach chashva Esther bedata ki ulay achet hu mipnei shenenu mehasu'uda v'nitratzta lelech. But then she said, you know what? Maybe that wasn't what was wrong. Maybe what was wrong is, as brought in another Gemara, the Jews ate from the feast of Achashverosh, because, as Rabbi Zinsheim goes on to note, she says, go gather HaYehudim HaNimtzeim B'Shushan. Go gather the Jews who are found in Shushan, specifically. So Rabbi Zinsheim says, you know, That phrase, Hanimtzeim b'Shushan, only appears twice. Once here, and the other place regarding the people who ate at Achashverosh's meal. So she's saying, maybe the Jews ate at the feast, so now gather them and they will fast to atone for eating at Achashverosh's feast. So what Esther is trying to do, says Rabbi Zinsheim, is to atone for whatever was wrong, and that way they won't end up being being subject to this decree. So it's a different approach. Yes. Sorry, someone had a question? Okay. It's a very different approach. It's not the approach of stalling. Rather, it's the approach of, I think we can cure this ethically, she thought. I don't think we need to worry about me going to Achashverosh. And then she realizes, but there could be sins that haven't been atoned for, so let's try to take care of them with this fast. Okay. But here's the fascinating political idea that Yoram Chazoni floats. Very interesting idea, and like I said, a very important idea. Whether it's pshat and what's going on in Esther is really beside the point. It's a fascinating insight, which I wish I had seen a few weeks ago when we were reading about Yosef in the Chumash. We're already now past Yosef. He's ancient history, and the Jews are now slaves in Egypt. But it's a remarkable idea that he floats. If you have a Chumash Bereishit with you, you can use it, but I brought you the key verses on the sheet in sources 7 and 8. Take a look, please, at source number 7. This is dialogue between Yosef and his brothers. Actually, before we read it, let's go back a step. Yosef becomes very powerful in Egypt. What does Yosef have to sacrifice in order to become powerful in Egypt? What does he have to give up?
His identity?
His identity. What do you mean?
Well, he can't, although they keep referring to him as being Jewish, he can't act that way.
Meaning? You're right.
But he has to assimilate.
But how? Give me, spell
dress.
Out. How does he assimilate?
Dress. We don't know about food, but we know about dress. He behaves, addresses a certain way.
Right. He's given Egyptian finery.
He's married an Egyptian woman.
He marries Asnat, daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On. Right. And what else? A big one that we actually referred to earlier when we talked about Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah.
Well, as a matter of fact, on the contrary, when he explained their dreams, he said that it comes from Hashem.
He absolutely did. You're right. And that was what Susan pointed out, that he also was identified as Ivri. You are 100% correct. But right after that, they give him a new name. Safnat Paneach. Which, granted, Safnat Paneach is not Egyptian. Presumably they gave him the Egyptian version of that. They call him Dream Explainer. Or dream visionary, which isn't that catchy. But then again, neither is Safnat Paneach. Fine. The point is that Yosef has to surrender his identity in order to succeed in Egypt. In order for him to become the viceroy, he has to become Egyptian. But he does it believing that that's what God wants him to do. That's what I'm supposed to do, he says. And now take a look at source number 7. When Yosef reveals his identity to his brothers, he says to them, Ve'ata al te'atzevu, v'yichar b'yeinechem. He says, don't be upset. Ki mechartem osiena, because you sold me here. Fine. Ki lemechiyash shalachani elokim lefnechem. That's Shemot. Be careful with that. That if you printed it out, know that that actually requires being put in Geniza. I apologize. I missed that. He said
to them that whatever Elokim chashava letova.
Nachon. But his point is, I was sent to Egypt to make sure you would have food. There's been a famine for 2 years. We have another 5 years coming. God sent me here in order to help you. I have a mission to perform. This is what God wants me to do. That's the first stage. But here's the remarkable thing. And I read it this past week in Parshas Vayechi, and I completely missed it. Without Hazoni, I would still not understand it. Take a look at source number 8. Source number 8 happens when Yosef is dying. Actually, sorry, it's not when Yosef is dying. It's after Yaakov's death. When Yosef's brothers come to him and say, our father said you shouldn't get angry at us and all of that, don't harm your brothers. And Yosef says back to them, don't worry about it. He says, Ve'atem chashavtem alai ra'a? You thought to do something bad to me. Elokim chashava letova. God thought it for the best. Leman aso kayom azela chayot amrav, so that I would be able to, or we would be able to, have many people survive. And so he says, Ve'atal tihiro, don't worry about it. Anochi achalkel eschem ve'es tapchem. I'm going to feed you. I'm going to feed your kids. Don't worry about it, he says. He reassures them. Isn't that sweet? Isn't that nice? Tell me something. What year of the famine is this? Susan says 2. Guess again. Nope, not 2. Guess again.
Famine over?
Oh, it is so over.
It's 2 years still.
Yaakov lives in Egypt for 17 years. Even if the famine actually continued to its end, remember that we are taught that the famine actually stops when Yaakov comes down. But even if it goes to its full length, another 5 years, the famine's been over for a dozen years. Who are you feeding, Yosef? They can go back to Israel. Why are they still living in Egypt at all? And the problem here is, and this is Hazoni's point, Yosef has become so enamored of his mission, the sense that God wants me here being the viceroy, that he persists in it even after it's over. Take a look at source number 9, please. He points out the extent to which Yosef gets stuck in this role. He wants to bury his father. How does Yosef get the right to leave the country and bury his father? He has to go to other servants of Paro and say to them, go tell Paro my father made me swear that I would take him out. Yosef has suddenly lost his nerve, right? Yosef, who is able to ride roughshod over everybody he needs to ride roughshod over. He has no problem talking to Paro. Suddenly, Cat got his tongue. Can you do me a favor? Talk to Paro for me. I took an oath. Take a look at source number 9. Pharaoh does indeed consent to allow Joseph and his brothers to go up with a military escort while their children and herds are held hostage in Goshen. But what kind of behavior is this on Joseph's part, going to Pharaoh's other servants and begging them to try to influence him? And this only if Joseph has managed to find favor in your eyes, then will you please? He says, Joseph is stuck. And there is likewise no question, but that a man such as Joseph necessarily feels himself to be free, as he gives orders to others morning and night, and disposes of their lives, loved ones, and property as he deems fit. But compelling as this experience may be, it is illusion. For the first among slaves may be powerful, but a slave he remains. Joseph looks really impressive, but the truth is, he's just a prisoner of Paro at this point. And so he actually gives you a very interesting contrast. He contrasts Yosef and Moshe. Take a look at source number 10 on the next side. It is not Joseph's building of Egypt which is unique in history, for there is virtually no man who does not work to build up the place in which he lives. What is unique is Moses' rejection of Pharaoh's court with all the power that it offered him, in order to protect a slave who was being treated unjustly. Moshe knows he's a Hebrew. He would have been justified in saying, let me stay in the palace. Right? I'll have a position of influence. I can help my people. And he throws it all away in order to save a Jew from the Egyptian who is beating him. It's the opposite of what Yosef is willing to do. So, this is Esther's problem, says Hazoni. She has an overpowering sense of destiny. Remember, we talked about why she hid her identity, didn't tell anybody, right? And we suggested that she went to Ahasuerus thinking that this was necessary in order to be in a position to help her people. She said, I need a position of power in the palace. And so she hides her identity in order to make herself more acceptable to Ahasuerus. And now she's stuck in that mode, where the most important thing, like Yosef, is to keep my position. And so Mordechai says, the Jews are in trouble, we need you. And she says, yeah, but I was supposed to hold this position of being queen. If I go to him unasked, then I'm going to lose all that power that God wants me to have. You follow? I think it's a brilliant approach. She's become a slave to destiny, effectively. Now, there's a second half to this, which is how Mordechai convinces her then. So we're going to have to look at that. We're not going to get to that today. We've got 3 minutes left. But the second half will be, so how does Mordechai succeed in convincing her? Sorry, Chana, what? Nope. Okay. But I did want to take a moment just to address the second question I asked about this chapter, right? That's the first question we asked about the chapter, is why is Esther refusing? And now we have either very practical answers. She's stalling, she's delaying, there's time yet to go. Or the people can atone without me going to Ahasuerus. Or this idea here that she's worried about losing the position that she thinks God wants her to have. By the way, someone wrote to me a private message in the chat asking, aren't the Jews behaving like Vashti by not conforming to the rules and the needs of the king? So anybody who acts like Vashti ends up with a sentence and gets them. You could definitely see that. But actually, there's a whole other piece that I didn't get into here about how Esther is acting like Vashti, because she's flouting the rule. No one gets to walk out to Ahasuerus. She's going to do the same thing that Vashti did, in the sense that she's going to reject the royal order, but she's going to get away with it. But going back to the question I wanted to answer briefly, I asked in the beginning of this chapter, Ahasuerus isn't going to let anybody in uninvited. That's a terrible way to run a government. Right? I mean, how do you get anything done? How do you get new ideas? But I think this is consistent with the idea that I floated for you in the beginning of chapter 3, that Ahasuerus elevated Haman in order to protect himself from the kingdom. Ahasuerus would like nothing more than for people not to bother him. Bigthan and Teresh tried to kill him. That put a scare into him. He said, now I'm going to interpose Haman between myself and everybody else. You have any issues? You have any questions? You have any needs? Go to Haman for stuff. I want to see the king. Yeah, the king doesn't want to see you now. Sorry. You don't get to, you don't get to show up in my palace. You have any issues? Take them up with Haman. So I think that's what's going on. It's this fear after Bigthan and Teresh that blocks everybody out. So what
it's
we're going to...
It's interesting that Haman shows up uninvited in the message of home.
Yep.
He's the only one.
Yes, and that's something we're going to definitely have to talk about. Chana points out that in the middle of the night when Ahasuerus can't sleep in chapter 6, he asks Mi Bechatzer, who's out in the yard, and the answer is it's Haman, who is not getting in. He's waiting out in the courtyard at that point. It is the middle of the night, after all. But Ahasuerus says, have him come in, but that's more, I think, about trapping Haman than anything else. We'll see as we go along, but there's more going on between Ahasuerus and Haman at that point. But what I want to do next time is ask the question of how Mordechai convinces Esther to go to Ahasuerus. What exactly is the sales pitch here? And in particular, it's 2:30, but if you want to take a look, not right now, but later, at chapter 4, at sentences 13 and 14, there's a false note in Mordechai's pitch to Esther. Mordechai says to Esther, who knows whether this is your time? Who knows if this is why? That has got to be the worst pep talk from a coach, like, all time, right? The coach's job is to say, this is your time, not to say, who knows? Maybe it's like he's Woody Allen suddenly. I don't know. Maybe this is your time. Like, why is it that he can't tell Esther straight, this is it, go to Ahasuerus? So that's something that we'll have to talk about, God willing, next time. So thank you very much, everybody. Welcome back. And looking forward to continuing.
Well,